I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And this week I'm going to look at the later show trials of the Stalinist period. And I want to look at it from the perspectives of two historians, the first being Isaac Deutscher, and the second being Timothy Snyder. And I want to do this because, obviously, Isaac Deutscher's biography of Stalin is one of the kind of the great seminal accounts of the dictator, and told from the perspective of a Trotskyist Marxist historian who, whilst writing one of the most important accounts of Stalin's life, was obviously coming from a particular ideological perspective. The other account, a more recent account of the show trials and the terror in Bloodlands by Timothy Snyder, is given to us by a revisionist historian and somebody who has very different ideological perspectives to Deutscher, and it's interesting how the two views manage to kind of highlight different aspects or come up with different explanations for Stalinism, because the show trials and the terror themselves are such gruesome but such curious phenomena that really they often defy explanation, the question as to why it is at certain points revolutions seem to cannibalise themselves. And you can look for examples of this in France, in Russia, and also in China. It is a very pertinent one, and it perhaps one of the more important ideological questions of the 20th century. So without further ado, let's get started on Isaac Deutscher. So in his biography of Stalin, Deutscher starts off by making a comparison between Stalin and Robespierre of the French Revolution. And I read, "In the middle 30s begins the most obscure chapter in Stalin's career, the series of purge trials in which he destroyed nearly the whole old guard of Bolshevism. The period has often been compared with the closing phase of the Jacobin Revolution, the rule of the guillotine in France. In many respects, the similarity was indeed so close that some of the chief actors of the drama, as well as many outsiders, were tempted to overlook the differences. In Stalin's, as in Robespierre's reign of terror, it was the same macabre quality, the same black hues of irrational cruelty, the same mythological horror that the sight of a revolution devouring its own children never ceases to evoke. Up to a point, even the sequence of events is identical. Robespierre first defeated the Jacobin left, which was led by Hébert and Clouts, and he did so with the help of the Jacobin right, led by Danton. Then he destroyed Danton and his associates too." This is obviously a reference towards, firstly, the exiling of Trotsky, and then Stalin's ability to turn on Kamenev and Zinoviev. Then he destroyed Danton with his associates too, and secured, for a short time, the undisputed rule of his own Jacobin centre faction. We've seen Stalin as the leader of the centre faction in Bolshevism. We've seen him assisted at first by the Bolshevik right in defeating the left and then turning against the right. We've seen him finally as the triumphant leader of his faction in sole possession of power. Now, Deutsche goes on to say that the differences are that by 1794, Robespierre was dead, that his revolution had ended just 2 years into the really extremely bloody and radical phase of the French Revolution. But the really violent phase, in Deutsch's view, he says, of course, the Civil War is extremely violent, but the really savage phase of the Russian Revolution, or of the Stalinist Second Revolution, happens 20 years after the October Revolution, between 1936 and 1938. The Mensheviks, by and large, were able to either leave Russia or they were exiled. The majority of them who reconciled themselves to defeat were fairly content to serve the Soviet administration. They are later disposed of in the terror. The Mensheviks, social revolutionaries, people who were considered former people. These are people who, when the terror begins, which accompanies the show trials, these are the people who are considered to be the revolution's unfinished business. Now, Deutsche argues that there was an unspoken agreement against the Jacobinism, or the ability, the inclination of the Jacobins to turn on one another, and that the Bolsheviks all signed up to this and readily agreed that the one thing that should definitely be avoided was the guillotine for each other. And Stalin bore this in mind throughout much of the 1930s, in Deutsch's view. And he was once even somebody who decided to ignore the demands from Kamenev and Zinoviev to deal with Trotsky more harshly. He said, "We have not agreed with Zinoviev and Kamenev, but because we have known that a policy of chopping off heads is fraught with great dangers, the method of chopping off and bloodletting, and they did demand blood, is dangerous and infectious. You chop off one head today, another one tomorrow, still another one on the day after. What it ends up with will be left of the what in the end will be left of the party." Now, if Deutsche can be believed on this, then this explains Stalin's decision to exile Trotsky instead of having him executed. However, bear in mind, he does have him assassinated 11 years later, so he wasn't completely consistent on that one. One version that Deutsche gives about the causes of the terror was that the Bolsheviks had come to power with a particular programme of construction, of building a socialist society. They were a political party who could channel the energies of the revolution into creating a new Soviet Russia. He says, "For nearly two decades, Bolshevism resisted the gods that were athirst. Bolshevism really resisted these violent energies unleashed by the revolution. But when it succumbed to them, its prostration was even more frightful than that of Jacobinism." So these energies that were released by the revolution were inherently violent, had been suppressed, and burst out later on. Now, I don't buy it. Okay, a lot of what Deutsche says, I think, is valid, but this is an explanation I think is very weak, and I think there are much more convincing explanations. Now, if you were writing about this, don't discount Deutsche completely. It's important when you're looking, when you're perhaps constructing a historiographical essay, to look at answers that are perhaps incomplete. and say, well, at a certain point in time, perhaps during the mid-1960s, these ideas were prevalent at the time because of the discourses, the fashion within history, which was during the 60s, for the most part, Marxism. However, more nuanced answers come later on, just because one part of the journey to more sophisticated answers is perhaps questionable. Doesn't mean to say we should just ignore it from our essays. Okay, so that's my tip for the day. Now, part of the context of the show trials and the gradual move towards terror during the mid-1930s is firstly the exile of Trotsky. Trotsky was sent to Turkey in 1929, from where he sent various underground publications and periodicals, many of them read by Stalin. Stalin took them very seriously. He reminded himself that Lenin had published Iskra in Russia, the revolutionary newspaper, and he credited Iskra, probably incorrectly, credited Iskra with give it a big role in bringing about the revolution. I would doubt that entirely, but what matters is what Stalin was thinking. Obviously, the events of the 1930s are really, really key in all of this. The likes of Kamenev and Zinoviev, who were exiled in around the same time period as Trotsky, are allowed to return from Siberia very shaken and frightened and subdued by their experience, and realising perhaps they made a terrible mistake by not backing Trotsky against Stalin. And this means that you have this cowed opposition within the party to Stalin's policies, such as collectivization and the first five-year plan. Now, the consequences of collectivization and the first five-year plan, particularly collectivization, i.e. the Soviet famines, results in the first major challenge to Stalin's rule by 1934 during the Congress of the Victors. Congress of the Victors is meant to be this showpiece event, cheering Stalin at the successes of the first five-year plan. But what people are really thinking about is the famine that's killed about 5 million. It could be as many as 7. Some Ukrainian historians suggest it's an awful lot more. Killed 7 million people, 5 to 7 million, shall we say, within the Ukraine. This is what is really animating people's thoughts. And it's what makes Stalin feel particularly insecure. Many of the conspiracy theories that surround the assassination of Sergei Kirov, the Leningrad Party boss, emanate from the events of the Congress of Victors. At the Congress of Victors, Kirov's name is mentioned as a possible successor to Stalin. During the elections to the Central Committee, there were several hundred negative crosses against Stalin's name from delegates and only 3 against Kirov's. Now, the conspiracy theory is that Stalin saw Kirov as a rival, and very shortly afterwards had him assassinated. But I think history is actually messier than that. All the evidence points towards the fact that Kirov was gunned down by a man who had some kinds of resentment, some kind of possible mental health issues, and Stalin appears to be genuinely shocked when he hears of Kirov's assassination. I always liken it to Hitler's genuine surprise when he hears of the Reichstag fire. It's something for both men, consummate actors though they were. It's a very difficult thing to fake. However, what's true about both of them, and in Stalin's case doubly so, is they were both masters of seizing opportunities that events presented to them. And perhaps if there's one thing that distinguishes the consummate politician from most of the rest of us, it's the ability to do that, to seize the moment. It was always Khrushchev's contention that the NKVD, and he said this in the secret speech, had organised the murder, and many historians have been quite right in saying that Stalin certainly profited from it. The extent to which he was the authorizer remains questionable. I'm not sure. Doesn't mean to say that he wasn't. I just think that the case hasn't quite been made for that yet. Now, Timothy Snyder in Bloodlands said that there is actually quite a weak connection between the assassination of Kirov and the terror. So conventional thinking has it that when Kirov is bumped off, Stalin uses this as an excuse to carry out the terror. But Timothy Snyder has a slightly different hypothesis. He says, well, firstly, Kirov dies in 34 and the terror, the Great Terror, doesn't really get going till 1936. And the so what happens in the meantime? And he says, well, Stalin is building up to something, but not from 1934 onwards, but from 1933, from the arrival in the Reich Chancellery of Adolf Hitler. Why? Well, because Stalin's paranoia emanates.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, his paranoia is focused on the borders of the Soviet Union. He sees three powers, Germany, Poland, and Japan, all of whom have either invaded or defeated the Soviets in the previous 20 years, or invaded or defeated Russia in the previous 20 or so years, and all of whom are, in his view, dangerous counter-revolutionary forces. And the arrival in power of Adolf Hitler, a radical anti-communist who is determined and is an outspoken enemy of the Soviet Union, is determined to destroy communism wherever he sees it. This is a signal to Stalin that the world has changed and that the porous borders of the Soviet Union have allowed all manner of dangerous anti-revolutionary forces through. There were, by the late 1930s, still many former nobles, many former Tsarist officials, police officers who had gone to ground, who had reinvented themselves as proletarians, who had managed to hide, to pass themselves off. Stalin had always believed that the Soviet famines were really the result of troublemaking Ukrainian peasants who had put themselves in league with the Poles and were looking to separate Ukraine away from Russia and create some sort of Ukrainian nationalist satellite state, the likes of which that the Germans had briefly created in 1918. So Stalin saw a continuity between enemies overseas and enemies at home. And when the international climate changed in the early 1930s, he became concerned. But from 1936 onwards, when Hitler begins his expansionism and revanchism in the Rhineland, in Spain, and then later in Austria and Czechoslovakia, Stalin becomes absolutely convinced that this is a prelude to war against the Soviet Union. Stalin and Beria, for example, when they met Churchill during the war, was saying things like, you know, it's a damn good job that we did what we did in the 1930s. Can you imagine the mess we'd be in now if we hadn't have dealt with the kulaks, if we hadn't have dealt with all the traitors? And so Timothy Snyder makes the point that what the terror was a rush to secure the Soviet Union. Now, this all sounds like madness to anyone looking at it from our perspective. But if you think about it from Stalin's perspective, and we go beyond the kind of the simple accusation of paranoia and go deep into the worldview of a Bolshevik revolutionary, view that he and Lenin and the rest of the Bolsheviks had was that any revolution, any workers' revolution, would be swiftly followed by bloody counter-revolution. And this was borne out by the Civil War. Not only did white armies fight the Soviets from within the Soviet Union, but they also invaded externally, the British, the French, the Americans and the Japanese and the Czech Legion were all fighting the Bolsheviks on Russian soil in from 1919 onwards. Now, in the first phase of terror directed towards the party in 1933, deportations happened and exiling to Siberia. And then, in order to wrong-foot the opposition that Stalin believed existed within the party, people such as Zinoviev and Kamenev were allowed to return, and then they were encouraged to recount or to recount their previous views and to denounce their colleagues, normally people like Trotsky. During this phase as well, up to about 1935, there are hundreds of thousands of expulsions. And expulsions are a kind of death sentence, really. These are it's those who are expelled who their names lie on file. And when the Great Purge happens, it's these people who are arrested first. One of the things, interestingly, about the Great Purge, if you look in Sheila Fitzpatrick's book, Everyday Stalinism, there's a great explanation of this. The reason why the Great Purge radicalises so quickly and it goes from arresting people who conceivably, in the eyes of the party, could be guilty of something, to arresting people who have absolutely no involvement in anything at all and accusing them of the most bizarre things and executing them, is because of this system of blat in Russia, of clientism. It's hard enough to exist in Soviet Russia on your own or with a family at the best of times. But during the 1930s, periods of unparalleled economic and financial hardship due to the five-year plans make it almost impossible to survive without a patron of some sort within government. And there were all sorts of networks of favours, backhanders, people who you could contact or bribe or who were your friends or you could sleep with. who could ensure that you got an apartment somewhere, or you got a reasonably good job in the government, or you got you were able to eat. So clientism, or blat as it's called in Russia, was an absolutely indispensable part of living. Now, when a government official in the housing department is arrested for being a Trotskyite, the first thing they would ask him is, not what have you done, but who do you know? And then he would reel off a list of everybody who he'd done favours for, or who had done favours for him. And they would all be arrested. So here's how we go from the level of official state terror against state victims to this radicalised random terror. The other way that it happens is that each town and city is given quotas and targets to fulfil of executions. Stalin is of the view, because time is running short and a war is coming, that it's better to kill 100 innocent men and get one guilty one than the other way around, than nothing at all. So they set quotas for arrests and executions, and NKVD are expected to fulfil and actually beat those quotas. Now, on the subject of the trials, the thing that tends to be kind of glazed over, I think, in history textbooks, was that there were many, many, many hundreds of them, really. A great deal were focused on the lower echelons of the party, the lower echelons of the party being purged in the supposed lull period of 1934-35. But the main ones, there are four that need to be kind of mentioned in any history essay on this subject. The trial of the 16, which included Zinoviev, Kamenev, Smirnov, Makovsky, etc. That was in August 36. The trial of the 17, Pyatakov, Radek, Sokolnikov, Muralov, and Tukhachevsky, who is the military figure who had been accidentally denounced by Radek. That trial, the Tukhachevsky trial, comes slightly after the 17. And with Tukhachevsky, begins the purge of the army, which is perhaps a story for another time, really. And then the trial of the 21, which includes Rykov, Bukharin, Krestinsky, Rakovsky, and Yagoda. Yagoda being the chief henchman to Stalin before he was replaced by Yezhov. Now, the gory details of the trials perhaps aren't the more important part. What is important, I think, is the fact that these clearly absurd claims were being disseminated. And there are two sources of interest in how those claims were received. Firstly, if you look at the Stalinist sympathisers in the West, the likes of Sidney and Beatrice Webb in Great Britain, and Leon Fulchwanger, and in Germany, these were all people who weren't actually communists themselves, but looked sympathetically on the Stalinist project and saw it as a good, you know, modernist engagement, or good a good modernist project, a perceived wild and backward country was being brought into the 20th century, if a little bit roughly, but certainly benignly in their view. The extent to which they could rationalise the show trials, that they could look at the accusations of sabotage and attempts to assassinate Stalin and all this nonsense against the likes of Zinoviev and Bukharin, and say, well, yes, that seems pretty good to me, and, well, they must have done something, and Stalin wouldn't be doing this. We're absolutely sure Stalin wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't strictly necessary. Or things like, well, you know, there's been a revolution going on in Russia, and didn't they have to spill a bit of blood in the French Revolution, but France turned out okay. Even Roosevelt was certain that at some point the Soviet Union would emerge into this model republic. Once it had got the nastiness out of the way, was his view. So there was an awful lot of indulgence from overseas. And the show trials were broadcast around the world. I say broadcast, they were shown around the world in cinemas as newsreels. And if you look at, again, the works of Sheila Fitzpatrick, she looks at the reactions of everyday Russians, and they range from total disbelief and a kind of a head-scratching confusion as to what on earth the government is doing, to an active and almost quite dramatic engagement with this fantasy that's being presented to them, that these hounds, these villains, should be persecuted for what they have done. The popularity of Stalin throughout the 1930s amongst ordinary Russians is a very complex thing to gauge, but, you know, people who are spending long periods of time in poor accommodation, with a generally kind of low standard of living, invariably aren't too happy about that. So this mass outpouring of sympathy for the leader wasn't necessarily there. But whilst there were large numbers of Soviet citizens murdered in the purges, as a whole, it's a tiny, tiny percentage. And most Soviet citizens are aware, on some level, of what's going on, but they don't encounter it or engage with it directly. When people are denounced, they are dangerous and shunned and ignored. But for the most part, most Soviet citizens don't want to know. It's much like Germany and the Holocaust. It's one of these open secrets where people can know if they want, but it's better not to know. The other aspect of public engagement with the show trials and with the terror, there's a huge influx of information volunteered from the general public, partly about their neighbours, partly about, sometimes even about people they don't know, of denunciations. And the Soviet Union becomes this radical denunciation culture, where terror, in a way, has a kind of a grassroots origin. And this is another a way in which the terror itself radicalises throughout the 1930s. Anyway, I've gone on for far too long, so I will leave you there, and I will catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. By the way, if you're a teacher and you're listening to this and you want a whole bunch of new free resources, get yourself over to outstandinghistory.com/instant-access. And there's my new newsletter there, full of useful stuff for history teachers wherever you are. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.